I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Tonight, President Barack Obama will be delivering his farewell address from his hometown of Chicago. In his political career, his speeches challenged established policies and comforted the nation in times of sorrow. Today, we'll remember the president's greatest oratorical hits and explore the rhetoric that brought Obama to national prominence in the first place. Then, we'll look at preserving a neighborhood with a unique Kansas City flair, Westport. Can its historic brick structures and eclectic character survive in today's economic environment? Later, we'll bring you this week's Statehouse Blend, Missouri. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Tonight, President Obama will deliver what he's calling a farewell address to the nation. We don't know what he'll say, but he's expected to talk about what he thinks are his most important accomplishments and offer a vision for the country one last time on a nationally televised platform that probably won't be afforded him once he's a former president. We thought it would be interesting to mark this day by looking back on some of Obama's other speeches, the oratory that brought him to prominence in the first place and that has helped him, or not, in his years in the White House. Dr. Robert Rowland specializes in political rhetoric. He's a professor of communication studies at KU, and he joins us from the studios of KPR. Robin, thanks for joining us this morning.
Great to be here.
And this is a specialty of yours, so remind us, what makes for a great political speech?
The most effective presidents have their own message, and they keep with that message as a strategic device, but also adapt to the audience and the situation. Some presidents, President Clinton is a great example of that, are very tactical. They'll say very, very different things to different audiences. But a president like Reagan or a president like Obama has the same basic message defending his program, but also talking about what it means to be an American. And they keep to that message and only adapt at the margins. And those presidents tend to be the ones who can influence the direction of the country in a greater way than the tactical president.
So in your professional opinion, as an expert on these things, do you think Barack Obama will go down as one of the great political speakers?
I think that's definitely the case. In the 20th and 21st century, we have both Roosevelts. We, of course, have Dr. King. Reagan, and then President Obama. We didn't have John Kennedy very long, but he also was an extraordinarily eloquent president. And especially in this period, that there's almost been a dialogue between FDR and Reagan and then Obama about the proper role of government.
So you've named a top 10 of President Obama's greatest hits, and one of those, I see, that it's no surprise to anyone, is the speech that quite literally made him famous at the Democratic National Convention in 2004, back when he was still a state senator in Illinois. How did he come to be giving this speech anyway?
His name was given to John Kerry, who made the extraordinarily risky judgment to have a state senator give the keynote address. But what a great judgment. I mean, Obama was virtually unknown. The major networks, the TV networks, didn't cover it live. Hmm. But on cable, the speech is about 19 minutes and one commercial break, and people were talking about him as a future president of the United States.
Well, let's turn the dial back and remember by listening to a little bit of that speech from the Democratic Convention in 2004.
It is that fundamental belief, I am my brother's keeper, I am my sister's keeper, that makes this country work. It's what allows us to pursue our individual dreams and yet still come together as one American family. E pluribus unum, out of many, one. Now, even as we speak, there are those who are preparing to divide us, the spin masters, the negative ad peddlers, who embrace the politics of anything goes. Well, I say to them tonight, there is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America. In the end, that's what this election is about. Do we participate in a politics of cynicism, or do we participate in a politics of hope? John Kerry calls on us to hope. John Edwards calls on us to hope. I'm not talking about blind optimism here, the almost willful ignorance that thinks unemployment will go away if we just don't think about it, or healthcare crisis will solve itself if we just ignore it. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something more substantial. It's the hope of slaves sitting around a fire singing freedom songs. The hope of immigrants setting out for distant shores. The hope of a young naval lieutenant bravely patrolling the Mekong Delta. The hope of a mill worker's son who dares to defy the odds. The hope of a skinny kid with a funny name who believes that America has a place for him, too.
That was 12 and a half years ago at the Democratic Convention, before anyone thought he would ever be president. Dr. Robert Rowland, what was so great about that speech? Was it what he said, or was it how he said it?
It was what he said. He is effective in delivering a speech, but, you know, if you just think of all the actors who would be much better at delivery, but what he said was extraordinary. In that passage, he hit on two themes that he has talked about ever since. He talks about that while recognizing our differences, that what unifies us is more important than those differences, that there's not a white America and a black America, there's the United States of America. And then he's talked about a vision of the American dream, which is focused on the entire community. And we heard that with that passage at the very end, that about the skinny kid with a funny name who thought there was a place in America for him as well. And those two themes are two of the three themes that he has talked about in this entire 12 and a half years.
You have written a lot about President Obama's rhetorical style. You've also written about President Reagan's style. How would you compare these two? How are they the same? How are they different?
They are almost in dialogue on the proper role of government. So President Reagan came at a time when he thought government was too big. He famously said in his first inaugural that in the present crisis, government is the problem, government is not the solution. Although people forget the introductory line in the present crisis. And Obama has said that in the crisis we face, we need more government to help people have an opportunity to do what they cannot do for themselves. In their vision of the United States, of people that are more alike than they are different, President Reagan and President Obama, you know, they say pretty similar things mm-hmm. in their vision of an inclusive America, and they're both optimists. The audacity of hope, and it's morning again in America.
Yeah.
They're very similar that way.
Which is a contrast with rhetoric that we may have become more familiar with in the last campaign.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
And we'll get to that for sure. But let me move us forward 4 years from the speech we just heard to a speech during the 2008 campaign. And this is the speech that then-candidate Senator Obama gave on race. It was incredibly important in the moment that he gave it. Can you just remind us briefly of the context for this speech?
Well, there were a variety of clips from Obama's minister saying
Jeremiah Wright.
Right, saying quite radical things. At one point, I think he talked about the U.S. of KKK, and he said, at one point, he says, not God bless America, but God damn America. Really controversial things, and they were playing almost in a loop on cable television.
So, candidate Obama had to respond.
That's right.
Well, let's take a listen.
This is where we are right now. It's a racial stalemate we've been stuck in for years.
And contrary to the claims of some of my critics, black and white, I have never been so naive as to believe that we can get beyond our racial divisions in a single election cycle or with a single candidate, particularly a candidacy as imperfect as my own. But I have asserted a firm conviction, a conviction rooted in my faith in God and my faith in the American people, that working together, we can move beyond some of our old racial wounds, and that, in fact, we have no choice. We have no choice if we are to continue on the path of a more perfect union. For the African-American community, that path means embracing the burdens of our past without becoming victims of our past. It means continuing to insist on a full measure of justice in every aspect of American life. But it also means binding our particular grievances for better health care and better schools and better jobs to the larger aspirations of all Americans. The white woman struggling to break the glass ceiling, the white man who's been laid off, the immigrant trying to feed his family. And it means also taking full responsibility for our own lives by demanding more from our fathers and spending more time with our children and reading to them and teaching them that while they may face challenges and discrimination in their own lives, they must never succumb to despair or cynicism. They must always believe that they can write their own destiny.
That was candidate U.S. Senator Barack Obama speaking about race back in 2008. Dr. Robert Rowland, why did that speech make your greatest hits list?
It's an extraordinary moment. It was an impossible situation for Obama, and yet he did something really extraordinary. He was honest about the subject of race. He talked about how people of color and how white Americans felt, and then transcended the moment by arguing that we're better off together, that we have to recognize the sins of the past, but that it's great to move forward. We need to move forward to help the entire American community. This is a speech that major commentators compared to things that Dr. King said, that Abraham Lincoln said, that John Kennedy said. In a crisis situation or campaign, it's the most extraordinary speech that I've ever seen in a political campaign.
We're talking with Dr. Robert Rowland about speeches by President Obama. This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Brian Ellison. Dr. Rowland, issues of race figured fairly prominently in this most recent presidential campaign as well. And of course, President-elect Donald Trump's rhetorical style has come in for a lot of criticism. On the other hand, it was very effective in many ways. How would you describe his rhetorical style?
Well, it's a classic populist style, where he is playing upon a lot of people are hurting, and he is definitely reacting to that, and he's definitely playing upon people's fears. From what I've read, this message resonates most strongly in areas where there isn't very much of an immigrant population, or when where there hasn't been a terrorist incident. But he's playing very strongly on people's fears, and this is definitely a rhetoric that divides us rather than unifies us. And that way he's quite different from Obama, but he's also quite different from Reagan.
You know, I guess partly isn't this a matter of perspective, though? I mean, you say he's playing on their fears, but what a lot of his supporters would say in interviews at his rallies is he says what I'm thinking. He gives voice to what I've been feeling a long time. He gets us. Isn't that a good thing?
It certainly is true that the white working class in particular has felt ill-used, and they're right about this, by the political establishment, that there are things that could have been done that would have prevented the catastrophic decline in wage status, et cetera, that people in that and other groups have faced. you know, but in terms of actual threats, whether this is being done by immigrants or someone else, I think he is certainly drawing on people's feelings. I think those feelings really aren't supported by the best evidence. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's turn to one of Obama's speeches that sounds like it should be deadly dull, his speech on economic policy, which he delivered in, of all places, Osawatomie, Kansas. First of all, remind us why he came here to give this speech.
He came on almost the 100-year anniversary of a very famous speech that Teddy Roosevelt had given in Osawatomie. And he was trying, therefore, to talk about the reforms we need now. And this speech was really where he set the theme for the 2012 campaign.
And the last two speeches we heard were delivered on the campaign trail. This one is after 3 years of the grind of the presidency. Yes, he's setting it up for his next campaign. But should we notice a difference because he's already president?
Yes. One thing that impacted him in the first 2.5 years of his presidency was that he had talked so much about change and how that he could bring America together, and that had been used against him by Republicans in Congress. And when they opposed him, they would cite their own opposition as proof that he wasn't succeeding. But there had been a debt ceiling crisis that the previous summer in 2011, and that had convinced him that he needed to enunciate a message that more strongly attacked elites in the business community in particular, that talked about the rich-poor gap. And so the political situation had shifted, giving him a little bit more freedom for what he could say.
Well, let's hear how he handled that.
It's wrong that in the United States of America, a teacher or a nurse or a construction worker maybe earns $50,000 a year should pay a higher tax rate than somebody raking in $50 million. It's wrong for Warren Buffett's secretary to pay a higher tax rate than Warren Buffett. And by the way, Warren Buffett agrees with me. So do most Americans, Democrats, independents, and Republicans. And I know that many of our wealthiest citizens would agree to contribute a little more if it meant reducing the deficit and strengthening the economy that made their success possible. This isn't about class warfare. This is about the nation's welfare. It's about making choices that benefit not just the people who've done fantastically well over the last few decades, but that benefits the middle class and those fighting to get into the middle class and the economy as a whole. Finally, a strong middle class can only exist in an economy where everyone plays by the same rules, from Wall Street to Main Street.
And of course, President Obama was reelected after that speech. But here, I guess I have to ask, Robin, almost 6 years later, it feels like the message didn't really land. People don't feel like they're economically stronger now, many people, even though by many financial measures they are. Is that a rhetorical problem? I mean, is this a weakness in how Obama delivers these more complex messages?
You're definitely right that it's harder to deliver a more complex message. And you're also right that people don't feel things, in the same way that they did in an earlier time. Partially, it's just the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009 was so deep. You know, the things he got done after he was reelected have affected income inequality. You know, we heard themes in those remarks very much like Bernie Sanders was going to emphasize in 2016.
Yeah. So, Yeah, I think that's an excellent observation. So we're running a little short on time, and I want to listen to one more clip. And it's the kind of speech that no president wants to give, but of course they all have to at some point during their presidency. Let's take a listen to some of President Obama's eulogy after the mass shooting at a church in Charleston, South Carolina.
To the families of the fallen, the nation shares in your grief. Our pain cuts that much deeper because it happened in a church. The church is and always has been the center of African American life. A place to call our own in a too often hostile world. A sanctuary from so many hardships. Over the course of centuries, black churches served as hush harbors where slaves could worship in safety. Praise houses where their free descendants could gather and shout hallelujah. Rest stops for the weary along the Underground Railroad. Bunkers for the foot soldiers of the civil rights movement. There have been and continue to be community centers where we organize for jobs and justice, places of scholarship and network, places where children are loved and fed and kept out of harm's way and told that they are beautiful and smart and taught that they matter. That's what happens in church. That's what the black church means. Our beating heart.
President Obama in Charleston, South Carolina, after the shooting there. Dr. Robert Rowland, what do you hear in that speech?
An extraordinary moment. It's one of the several gun eulogies that he gave after shootings. And it's one particular manifestation of his appeal to the community values, that what unifies us in this case, he's talking about the black community in particular, is more important than what divides us. And this, of course, the speech ends with him singing a verse from Amazing Grace. It's just an extraordinary moment.
So a last and very quick question with the time we have left, Robin. What will you be looking for in President Obama's farewell address tonight?
I think he's going to talk about his accomplishments and what we have done together. And then I think he's going to return to the theme of the 2004 speech and talk about the importance of hope over other emotions.
Well, we'll all be listening for that together. Dr. Robert Rowland, KU Professor of Communication Studies. He joined us from KPR this morning. Robin, thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
When we come back, we'll look at Kansas City's Westport neighborhood. It's historic, older than Kansas City itself. It's also fun and hip. It's also crowded and choked with cars. What is its future? And how does one preserve all of the aspects of its character? We'll try to figure that out in a moment. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, we brought you special coverage of Eric Greitens' inauguration live from Jefferson City as Missouri's governor. You can listen to it at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at risk versus reward in the form of high school football. Is the sport too dangerous for minors? Also, the peace protests that nearly kept the U.S. out of World War I. Join us tomorrow for that. Today, we're talking about Westport. Kansas City is full of historic neighborhoods, but few have richer history than Westport, the point from which the Oregon and California and Santa Fe trails split to make their westward journeys. It's always been a center of commerce, always had a lot of traffic, always had, shall we say, a vivid nightlife. But new development is causing some to question whether its unique character might be in jeopardy. And To help us look back and look forward, we're joined this morning by Greg Allen. He's past president of Historic Kansas City and currently serves on its board. Greg, good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
And also Mary Jo Draper. She's a publisher of the Midtown KC Post and a local historian. Hi, Mary Jo.
Hi, it's great to be here.
I should mention both of them will be speaking as part of a panel tonight at the Kansas City Public Library's Plaza Branch, the subject Preserving Westport. Greg, what is it about Westport that needs to be preserved? What sets it apart from the rest of the metro?
Well, Westport is one of the most historically significant parts of this region. It has a richly layered history of the frontier era and the trails era. A Civil War battle was fought in and around Westport. And it has had a tremendous role in the urban development of Kansas City, Missouri. Notwithstanding all that, we don't really have the database we should have and the assessments we should have on the existing state of historical resources in Westport. And that's what Historic Kansas City is championing at this point, and that is we need to do a historical mm-hmm. survey mm-hmm. of the Westport district.
Well, I mean, one thing we do know is that Westport has changed a lot through the years. It's somehow always managed to find its way. Mary Jo, not the first time it's seen changes, right?
Yeah, exactly. We think of Westport as a frontier town and its history as being really rich with that frontier history. But the truth is that almost all of those frontier buildings that we used to know were torn down by the 1930s. And what is in Westport now is, as Greg said, another layer of history on top of that frontier history. Buildings that were built in the 1930s, as much of Midtown was, as streetcar suburbs. So smaller brick buildings that one or two stories high that give it a really unique character and flavor.
And so what's the threat exactly? What do you see as the threat to saving or to keeping around this unique character?
Well, I think one of the things that happened was recently that got a lot of people in the community talking about this was when there was a building at the corner of Westport Road and Broadway, which has to be one of the most iconic corners in Kansas City, one of the corners where almost everybody in the metro area, anybody coming here from out of town, has visited that area. And when people saw a building coming down on that corner, they started to say, wait, what's going on? Do we need to think about preserving Westport?
Let's just use that example. That was an old, iconic, historic building, but it was also, I don't remember now, was it a frozen yogurt shop or a smoothie shop?
It was.
It was Starbucks.
It was Starbucks.
It was Starbucks.
Is it enough for you to preserve just the sort of the structures, the skeletons of the old buildings, or is there something about the character of the businesses within them that matters too?
Well, certainly they both matter, and what we need to have is an informed conversation about how Westport should be redeveloped in the future. I don't think the threat is big box retailers because you can't assemble that kind of ground in Westport. Mm-hmm. I don't think the threat is a lot of national retailers who require big floor plates because, again, you can't assemble that kind of space in Westport. And, in fact, we've had, a very positive trend to local restaurants in Westport. That's been, I don't think, a deliberate strategy, but it has worked very, very well in terms of attracting new crowds to the place. But we need to have better information about what we've got left, what condition it's in, how much of it might be eligible, let's say, for listing on the National Register of Historic Places. Maybe we should have a special review district, as Main Street does. You're familiar with efforts on the plaza going back to the 1980s. To protect historic fabric there. Brookside has had these issues. Mm-hmm. It's kind of strange. Westport has not had that conversation, and we feel it's high time we do so.
But let's talk about the plaza since you brought it up. The plaza is essentially a collection of outside businesses, non-local businesses. It's a shopping district that, for the most part, there are exceptions, but for the most part, it's a collection of stores and restaurants that you would find in any large American city. Is that preservation as far as you're concerned, or as long as the old buildings are still there? Mary Jo?
Well, Westport or the Plaza clearly has changed in our lives. We've seen it change from more locally owned businesses, yeah, and places where people, older people lived, now to more upscale apartments and that sort of thing. And I think one of the side issues, it's not just about preserving buildings. To me, it's about preserving neighborhoods that we have. We're really, really lucky in Kansas City, in Midtown Kansas City, to have, I think, some of the strongest neighborhoods anywhere in the country. Mm-hmm. And if people get priced out of neighborhoods, if development pushes people out of neighborhoods, we are in danger of losing those really strong neighborhoods. And I come to this from the perspective of sort of being an advocate of neighborhoods. So I do think we've changed the Plaza a lot. We've allowed the Plaza to change a lot. And maybe that's appropriate to do in Westport, but maybe I agree with Greg that we need to have a conversation about it before it just happens.
Have the two of you talked with business owners? Do we know what they're saying? Do most of them even own the building they're in and have any say in this matter, Greg?
Well, Westport does have a diversity of ownership, and that's a very big difference with the Plaza. With the Plaza, you have whatever the retail mix may be currently, you have a singular owner for most of the retail and entertainment area.
Yeah.
In Westport, it's far more diverse. We have had a meeting to which owners were invited. A number of them came. And I think we had a very good conversation about what the options might be eventually. But again, primarily, our immediate interest is a historical survey and all of the branding and marketing opportunities that that might spawn if we have created a higher and more developed and better documented mm-hmm. understanding of what the historical resources of Westport really are.
I mean, the Westport, there is a business association in Westport. Do they share your interest in preserving the history, Mary Jo?
I think that, yes, they do. I think that they recognize that it's an asset. But, of course, they're business people. So, I mean, we've got to weigh, as we often do in Midtown, we've got to weigh the interests of businesses. We've got to weigh the interests of people living in the neighborhoods. And we've got to weigh the interests of the institutions that are in those neighborhoods. Because we have nonprofit businesses. We have churches. We have, you know, in Westport, we have a post office. We have a library in Westport. Mm-hmm. So Westport is more than just business.
It's not just a retail district. It's a real neighborhood.
Right. And to me, the conversation needs to be inclusive of businesses, of course, but a broader conversation that takes all of those into account and figures out how we can strengthen things for everybody.
Well, I mean, let me ask you. You mentioned the possibility of a historical designation or even calling it a historic district. What, practically speaking, does that even mean? And is it more than just saying this building is historic and this building is historic? What does it mean to call a whole neighborhood that?
Well, historic districts are well known in Kansas City. I live within walking distance of Westport, and my neighborhood's a historic district mm-hmm. and has been since 1985.
Meaning what? That no one can build there without some special permissions?
In that case, it is a Kansas City local historic district, and we have a preservation commission at City Hall that provides oversight as to what can be built there and major remodeling projects. So that, as an owner and as a neighbor, is very important to me because I feel that it protects property values.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little surprised that Westport isn't already one of those districts, given what we all know about its history.
Well, I think a lot of people are.
Yeah.
why can you say why it isn't? I mean, have there been previous attempts to go that direction?
There have been attempts to think about preserving Westport. I know as far back as the 1930s, there was I was doing some research recently about a building that used to sit at the corner of 40th and Pennsylvania. There was the oldest Presbyterian church west of the Mississippi sat there. In about 1935, there was a federal commission that was looking at historic preservation, and it said that was one of the three most important buildings in Kansas City, along with the Harris Kearney House and the Warnell House.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 years later, it was torn down.
Yeah.
So there have been attempts, but there's nothing in place right now that really safeguards things.
So go ahead, Greg.
Well, I think Westport is maybe one of the early examples of an older commercial district in Kansas City. The city kind of passed it by because it was early, it was older, and I don't think it attracted the kind of attention that it really warranted until beginning in the 1970s when you had Westport Square revived and other efforts made. And so it's been sort of a 40-year work in progress. But the one thing that has not been done is the greater element of protection that might be afforded by historical designations, either of individual properties or district.
Can you give us an example of a particular building in Westport that you think might be tempting for someone to not preserve, but that you really would care about being preserved?
Oh, I would be very difficult to pick one out.
Is there a particularly historic building that is the kind of building that you want to make sure stays there for a long time?
Well, I think the row of storefronts that comprise Westport Square along Westport Road, I think that's highly important. Mm-hmm. I think it's highly important not only because it is an early streetcar suburb and neighborhood commercial district, but because it's achieved a historical significance in its own right since the 1970s. I think people think of Westport and they think of that row of buildings, and it's iconic.
Yeah. Very quickly, Mary Jo, does it seem to you like it's always not until there's a threat to a neighborhood that people then raise the alarm about preservation?
Absolutely. But I do think that in the, you know, preservation has become more and more important to people. And we went through a process in Midtown a few years ago called the development of the Midtown Plaza Area Plan. And citizens from neighborhoods all across Midtown spent hours and hours and hours in meetings trying to come up with some kind of common vision for what the future of the Midtown they'd like to see. And one of the things that they said was over and over and over again that history and the architecture of Midtown is really, really important to them.
Well, we will be following this story with you to take a look at how preservation unfolds in Westport. Greg Allen is past president of Historic Kansas City, serves on its board and chairs its advocacy committee. Thanks for being here, Greg.
Thanks very much.
And Mary Jo Draper is a historian and publisher of the Midtown KC Post. Thanks to you for being here.
It's always great to be back.
Yesterday, Up to Date brought you the Missouri governor's inauguration. Just after that, KCUR Statehouse Blend did something a little different. We met up with Politically Speaking, our neighbor podcast from across the state. Here's the result. From KCUR 89.3, I'm Brian Ellison.
And from St. Louis Public Radio, I am Jason Rosenbaum.
Today, earlier, Eric Greitens was sworn in as Missouri's 56th governor.
And we thought it would be a good idea for these two mighty forces of Missouri political podcasting to join together to interview the leaders of the Missouri House.
And we're now joined by the Speaker of the Missouri House, Todd Richardson. Speaker Richardson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me today.
You know, I think a lot of folks have said over the course of the last couple weeks when there's been a lot of talk about the change and the excitement, you know, there are a couple issues that Governor Nixon vetoed, but the Republicans have had a veto-proof majority for several years now. What do you feel like has really changed?
Well, I think having that willing partner in the executive is just, there's no way, unless you've worked in this building, to describe what the impact is. And, you know, it's not just the issues that the governor vetoes. It's the entire topic of conversation often gets framed by what kinds of issues the governor's willing to work with you on and what's not.
One thing that I've heard from some of your Republican colleagues, including State Representative Kevin Engler, who was around during the Matt Blunt administration, is now that there is a Republican governor and a Republican legislature, and with such robust numbers, the Republicans can't really blame Democrats if things go wrong.
Sure.
So that's kind of a downside. If the state takes a turn for the worse, it might be bad news for the GOP. How does that feeling come into play as you're moving forward on this agenda?
Well, there's no question. When you have both supermajorities in the House, supermajorities in the Senate, and the governor's office, there's an increased responsibility on us to govern. And I think the way that we intend to do it is by following through on the things that we told voters as a party we were going to work on in the campaign. And I think if we'll keep focused on that, the state will be taken in a better direction. And I think people will see the results of that legislation.
You know, one of the things that theme of responsibility is something you mentioned in your opening address last week. And I think you said with greater
power comes greater responsibility.
Right. Isn't that a quote from Spider-Man?
Yes, I believe that.
I didn't even know that. That was one of the, somebody pointed that out to me, and I had no idea. So
Spider-Man may not have been the first, actually, but we'll look that up. We'll tweet about that.
Yeah.
But
I think Spider-Man's a good person to be quoting. I mean,
I would agree. Yeah.
You could do worse. You went on from there to talk about that responsibility includes hearing the voices of all Missourians,
sure,
including those that all of you represent. And I think you were talking to the Democrats there, saying you're working to incorporate all of those voices in as practical terms as you can. What does that look like? What does collaboration or working together or incorporating all those voices look like at a time when you don't really have to work with them because of the numbers you have?
We're going to move the policy agenda that we want to move as a caucus. But that doesn't mean that we have to be disrespectful of the minority or to shut them out of the debate. And beyond that, there are a whole host of issues which aren't particularly partisan. Workforce development is one that comes to mind almost immediately. It's a critical economic development challenge for this state, and it really doesn't have anything to do with partisanship. So we're going to look for and identify the kinds of issues where we can work across the aisle. But even on the deep contentious issues where there are true philosophical divides, we're going to be mindful and respectful of the voices that disagree with us.
So from something that might have some bipartisan traction to something that doesn't have any bipartisan traction at all, right to work is...
Well, that's not true. I mean, but right to work's been passed in the Missouri House with both Democrats and Republicans voting for
it. Like one or two Democrats, yeah. But continue.
Fair enough. and that is often the case in the Missouri legislature,
sure,
right? There's not necessarily strict party line votes on very many things. But generally speaking, Democrats have opposed right to work, and of course only isn't law now because of Governor Jay Nixon's veto pen. And by all accounts, it seems headed for passage. On what kind of schedule do you see that happening?
Well, I think it's something we're going to move, as I've said, very early in session. It's going to the hearing on that bill is going to have hearing Tuesday of this week, the day after the inauguration. And so I anticipate it'll move from there very quickly to the floor.
Even more quickly, this morning, the House General Laws Committee held a hearing on one of the ethics reform proposals that's out there, and then on 11-1 vote passed it on. That's the ban on gifts from lobbyists. I've heard people saying that this might pass the House as early as this week. Is that your hope?
Yeah, my hope is that we can get it to the floor this week and begin debate on it. I said at the end of last session that it was going to be the first bill that would leave the House. It will be the first bill that leaves the House. And it's really something that I consider sort of unfinished business from last year. So my hope is that we can get it through the process quickly, and then we'll move on to the other substantive priorities we've got.
I know this is a question I've been asking for well over a year, but I'll ask it again since lobbyist gifts and the revolving doors on top of mind. Do you really feel that these issues are going to change the culture in Jefferson City when a lot of the reasons we're talking about ethics come down to bad personal decisions and things that may not be able to be legislated?
Well, I don't think that's the only reason we're talking about these policies. Frankly, we were talking about these before some of the more high-profile personal instances that we had over the last couple of years. But I do think the combination of things that we're trying to do to improve overall the culture here in Jeff City will improve the environment here. And beyond that, I think it's just the right thing to do. And so we're going to keep moving forward on it. My hope is that it improves the culture here in Jeff City, and I think over time it will.
Another of those ethics proposals is from Governor Greitens, a revolving door ban, one for one, a year in the House means a year not serving as a lobbyist. We've already heard a fair number of senators saying they think that's DOA on the Senate side. Is it going to get hearings on the House side? Are we going to see action on that bill?
Well, the House passed the revolving door ban we have in place now last year. We actually were in favor of a longer ban. So we'll work with the governor to see where we can get that policy.
Jumping back to some of those issues that may have certainly some bipartisan interest, if not always agreement, transportation and infrastructure needs are something that Kansas City politicians talk a lot about.
Sure.
But haven't felt like they've seen a lot of action on over the last couple of sessions of the General Assembly. Do you see that moving forward in this session?
Yeah, I think transportation is critically important for the state overall, and I think figuring out where we're going to go in terms of funding our transportation networks critical.
What's your idea about that? Would you see some sources of increased revenue for transportation that are obvious to you?
I think what we need to do first is we need to start with breaking this challenge down into manageable chunks. And, you know, we've looked at transportation for so long as this massive problem, and the reality is we don't have a solution. There is no solution for a massive problem. I-70 alone is a $3 billion project. There's not a single revenue solution that anybody's proposed that's a $3 billion solution. So I think we ought to start by trying to find some general revenue sources to continue to fund transportation. And from there, we need to come up with a plan to fund the interstates.
But nothing that would involve tax increases, I'm guessing.
I don't see any support for that in the legislature in the short term.
I guess I just have to ask this question, and maybe it's a self-serving one, and it's to somebody who's not sharing my faith. But we did pass a historical symbolic milestone today. There's never been a Jewish person ever elected governor before, and especially after 2015 when, as a Missouri political community, we're dealing this wrenching conversation about whether there's anti-Semitism in Missouri politics. It seems that Eric Greitens' election, where he carried most of rural Missouri, as somebody from rural Missouri and as a leader of the Republican Party, what kind of message do you think it sends that Missouri elected its first and inaugurated its first Jewish governor, and he happens to be a Republican?
Yeah, I think it sends a powerful message and a powerfully positive message. That's not something that's going to hold a candidate back in this state. We are a state of deep faith, and we have strong faith communities across the state. And I know that faith is something that informs Governor-elect Greitens as it does me. And our faith may not be identical, but I think his election demonstrates that is not the kind of issue that represents a barrier to elected office in Missouri, and I think that's an extraordinarily positive thing.
All right. Any other questions here, Jason?
I have no other questions.
Well, then I am pleased. I know you've been on Politically Speaking before, but this is your first time with us on Statehouse Blend.
I'm glad to do it. We'll not make it the last.
This is it is part of our tradition that we ask our guest to choose the music that we will close the show with.
All right. How about I will give you all the choice of any Garth Brooks song you choose.
I'm looking at my colleague, Jason Rosenbaum, because I, of course, can't think of a single Garth Brooks song.
Would it be insulting if we did Friends in Low Places?
You know, that's the one we sing at Royals games with Garth Brooks.
I think that would be perfectly appropriate, both for the speaker from Popper Bluff and because of the Kansas City connection. How about that?
Friends in Low Places it is. House Speaker Todd Richardson of Poplar Bluff, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to my good friend and colleague, Jason Rosenbaum.
Thank you for having me as well.
Our producer today has been Matt Hodapp. See you on the radio. I thought you'd see there, and I saw the surprise, the fear in his eyes. I took his glass of champagne. I toasted you, said, honey, we may be through, and you'll never hear me complain. Cause I got friends in low places where the whiskey drowns and the beer chases. The full version of that edition of Statehouse Blend Missouri includes a response from the Democratic House leadership, too. You can find that and other episodes of Statehouse Blend Kansas and Missouri at kcur.org/statehouseblend or subscribe to both shows on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We should also mention Statehouse Blend Kansas will host a watch party of Governor Sam Brownback's State of the State address. That's tonight at 5 in Topeka. KCUR will air a taped broadcast of the speech at 7 p.m. You can listen to our previous programs on UpToDate. You can download our podcasts at kcur.org/UpToDate. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCURUpToDate. I'm at PTS Brian. Tomorrow on the program, the dangers of impact sports like football and also the untold movement of Americans who nearly kept the U.S. out of the First World War. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, happy birthday, Luke, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tadakoro. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date. Cause a big scene, just